Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Peniel E. Joseph. He is the author of The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century. Peniel Joseph is the Barbara Jordan Chair in Ethics and Political Values, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy, and Associate Dean for Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at the LBJ School of Public Affairs and Professor of History at the University of Texas at Austin. He is also the author of The Sword and the Shield. And welcome back to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Hey, good to be here, Hopeton.
Peniel, let's start off with you giving a short summary of what the book is all about.
Well, the book is part memoir, part historical analysis, and part political argument about three periods in American history that I describe as Reconstruction periods. The first is 1865 to 1898. The second is what some people think of as the heroic period of the Civil Rights Movement from 1954 to 1968. And the third is 2008 to the present. And I do it through looking at the different stories we tell ourselves about the country, Reconstructionist versus Redemptionist. Reconstructionists are supporters of multiracial democracy, and redemptionists are advocates of white supremacy and the lost cause, and how those two conflicts continue to shape American history and American politics since 1865. And I also talk about my own history and biography and the way in which Black history helped me make sense of those two different stories of Reconstruction and redemption.
So talk a bit about how the geography of racial borders in Queens, how you became painfully aware of that.
Yeah, I grew up in segregated Jamaica, Queens. It's interesting because it's the same neighborhood that Assata Shakur grew up in, even though she's 15 years older than me. And I remember her writing in her memoir how, you know, Queens was 100% Black. And the Queens I grew up in was 100% Black. So it was a segregated neighborhood in the 1980s, proud son of Haitian immigrants. And I got to be able to see sort of the entirety of the Black world right there in Queens, in the sense that there were people from the Caribbean and Jamaica and Guyana and the Bahamas. But then there were also people who were from Texas and South Carolina and North Carolina and Alabama and Tennessee, meaning that their families had migrated to New York and migrated to Queens, but they were from the South, Black folks from the South. And then there were also Black folks from West Africa. You know, we had immigrants from West Africa and other parts of the world. So I got to see a Pan-African diasporic vision and version of Blackness right there in Queens.
So how did your experiences growing up in Queens set you on the path to be a historian?
Well, it's my mother. My mother is 83 years old, who I talk about a lot in the book, Trevaine Joseph. She worked at Mount Sinai Hospital for 40 years. She was a lab technologist, and she was part of SCIU 1199. She's a historian. She's a writer. She's a deeply invested Christian, Black Christian. And she gave us, me and my older brother, who grew up to be a physician, she gave us all of that in the house. So we talked about social justice. We talked about Black history. We talked about Haitian history. We talked about the Reagan administration. I talk about election night 1980 that I remember when I was 8 years old. And I was on my first picket line in elementary school. So that household was a great, great household to understand Black history in a panoramic way. It's a great household to understand social justice, but also to understand the pragmatic application of social justice. So we just weren't having intellectual discussions. We understood the power of labor unions and the power of people organizing, and also the power of the Black church. We were part of New Bethel Baptist Church, and we were religious churchgoers.
So let's go back to the first Reconstruction in 1865 to 1898. One of the first things that popped into my mind is learning that it was the 1876 election that was a tie decided by Congress, where Rutherford B. Hayes agreed to pull the troops out of the South to get the votes he needed to become president. Talk a bit about, and the second thing also that you make very important is while there was Reconstruction, there was also incredible violence and anti-Black sentiment at the same time.
Yeah, so the Reconstruction period is really, really important. And I push back against certain scholars who end Reconstruction after that election of 1876 that you just spoke about. I think that we get another two decades because of Black people, primarily Black men and Black women, who are the co-architects of this effort to reimagine American democracy, who continue to push and strive for not just voting rights, but real citizenship and dignity. Simultaneous with the Reconstruction Amendments of 1868 to 1870, so we think about really 1866 to 1870, we think about the ratification of the 13th Amendment in December of 1865, the 14th Amendment, and the 13th Amendment ends racial slavery except in cases of punishment. The 14th Amendment is birthright citizenship and the Equal Protection Clause, 1868, and the 15th Amendment is Black male suffrage, which is going to provide voting rights for white women as well by 1920, and then Black women in 1965. So those Reconstruction Amendments really constitute a second American founding, where Black people are doing things like buying land, they are building churches, they're building schools, they're building civic and mutual aid organizations, they become entrepreneurs, they become farmers. There are great successes. Simultaneous with that is going to be the politics of racial terrorism. Sometimes we call it backlash and white supremacy. It's not just the Klan, it's just ordinary white people who a lot of times are killing, murdering, and marginalizing Black people. So we're gonna see a system of debt peonage that gets set up, a system of sharecropping that gets set up, a system of convict leasing that gets set up. So there's gonna be archipelagos of democracy, I call them, but really at the lower frequencies, Black people in rural Georgia, in Texas, in South Carolina, North Carolina, in Tennessee, in Louisiana, are really gonna experience huge, huge rounds of just everyday violence and also racial pogroms in places like Colfax, South Carolina, and Colfax, Louisiana, and places like Hamburg, South Carolina, and places like New Orleans and Memphis in 1866. So we talk, Hopeton, about Tulsa in 1921, but the beginning of all those massacres and all those white riots and racial terror assaults that kill sometimes dozens, sometimes hundreds of Black people, it's really right there during that period of Reconstruction.
One of the most underappreciated leaders of the late 19th century, early 20th century was Ida Barnett Wells.
Yeah.
She was sort of a trailblazer on reporting on lynching. And she was so good at it, she had to leave town because of her stories on lynching happening where she lived. Why do you think she is so underappreciated? Because you put Black women in this book front and center and really emphasize the important role of Black women in the leadership during the three Reconstruction periods. Why do you think people like Ida B. Wells, who was also one of the co-founders of the NAACP, don't get the attention they deserve from the general population?
Well, you know, I think that the first two Reconstructions are part of a period that really marginalizes the contributions of Black women. I think it's a combination of patriarchy. I think it's a combination of sexism. It's a combination of racism. It's happening both externally and internally. So externally, white folks are not recognizing her. And then internally, you're going to have Black folks like Du Bois and different people who feel in certain ways threatened by her, in certain ways in conflict with her. In certain ways, Ida B. Wells is not coming from a super poverty, and she's not coming from an African-American Ivy League elite as well. So just the very fact that she has sort of this middle-class educated origins, both of her parents are school teachers, her parents are active politically, but they die when she's just 16. She's not able to complete her formal education in the same way that people like Du Bois or other people were, although she's brilliant. And so I think that there's a lot of things that combine to marginalize her. And that's why I really look at Ida B. Wells and I look at Black women from all these periods of Reconstruction, because I think this third period of Reconstruction with the Nicole Hannah Jones and the Kimberly Crenshaws and the Stacey Abrams and the Tamika Mallorys and the Alicia Garzas and obviously Kamala Harris was the time period you've seen the most visible acknowledgement of Black women. And you can even see it in things like at the high level of, you know, who wins the MacArthur Genius Prizes and who wins, you know, you're seeing Black women, Gabby Foreman just won, who's a colleague, friend at Penn State. And it's great to see that happen. And I just wanted us to look at the through line. And again, I say they are co-architects. So Black men have done and achieved great things as well. But I think Black women, it's important to focus and at times center their story, because they tell us a different story about American democracy when we center their stories.
You state in the book that W.E.B. Du Bois was the most important scholar and social scientist of the 20th century, one of the founders of the NAACP, but also most importantly, within the context of your book, is his book, Black Reconstruction. Talk a bit about how there was efforts throughout to basically lie about the history of Reconstruction by white scholars, like I believe Dunning at Columbia. Yeah.
William Archibald Dunning. Yeah, certainly. You know, Du Bois, Black Reconstruction is the most important book Du Bois ever wrote, in my opinion. And he wrote many, many important books. So it's saying, you know, the souls of Black folks, the Philadelphia Negro. And the reason why I think Black Reconstruction is the most important is that that's still the best book ever written about Reconstruction, including when we think about Eric Foner's stuff, Stephen Hahn's stuff, and they would, I think, say the same thing or should. And the reason why it's so important is that it's written in 1935, and Du Bois, in a very comprehensive way, pushes back against the lie of the Dunning School of Reconstruction, the Gone with the Wind version of Reconstruction, Birth of a Nation, Klansmen versions of Reconstruction that are being taught in K-12 and are the stories that rationalize lynching, segregation, what is gonna become mass incarceration, the impoverishment and the imprisonment, the punishment, the demonization and dehumanization of Black people, right? And that story is the story of the lost cause, the story of sort of this outrageous dehumanization of Black people that is then justified by saying that the Klansmen are heroic and they did it to protect white women, right? And so Du Bois pushes back against all of that and shows us that Black people actually saved the country. They reimagined democracy. They fought in the Civil War. They were the ones who created the first public schools, the Reconstruction of politicians. They created the first anti-poverty New Deal efforts. They built infrastructure, and then they were shot and killed and murdered and maimed and marginalized and imprisoned for doing so. So that's what's so important about Du Bois. Du Bois shatters that white supremacist story through what he calls correctly Black Reconstruction. And he also theorizes about, white immorality and the evil of white supremacy by talking about white working class folks and how they weren't able to coalesce and form coalitions with Black people because of what Du Bois calls the public and psychological wages of whiteness, right? And just that sentence became something that was a founding principle of all these whiteness studies that Black and white and other scholars have done. David Roediger's The Wages of Whiteness, people talking about how the Italians became white, how the Jews became white, how different ethnic groups, the Irish became white. And so that book is a panoramic, theoretical, political, cultural, economic history of America during the aftermath of the Civil War. You know, I start the book with this epigraph from Du Bois in the introduction, A Nightmare is Still a Dream. So this is Du Bois in Black Reconstruction. He says, "Here was a land of poignant beauty, streaked with hate and blood and shame, where God was worshiped wildly, where human beings were bought and sold, and where even in the 20th century, men are burned alive." And so, you know, Du Bois also in his really inimitable poetic way and eloquent voice really also talks about these juxtapositions in the United States, this idea of beauty in a land where God is worshiped and these folks are supposed to be Christians and Black people are bought and sold, and that even in the 20th century, men are being burned alive, right? And men and women. So Du Bois really captures the tragedy, but also the triumph of the Reconstruction period in a way that, you know, nobody has ever repeated, even as folks win Pulitzer Prizes based on Du Bois' work, right? You know, and that's kind of how it always is, right? The Black people do the work and the other people get the prizes and the money and the acknowledgments and the accolades. Right. But so I think it's important for us to remember Du Bois. And Du Bois also coins the term abolition democracy, you know, and that's really important because that idea of abolition democracy has fueled the work of Angela Davis, but also the Black Lives Matter movement as well.
I thought it was very important to me the way this is part of memoir for you, because I'm always curious when academics are writing books, what is their personal background that inspired them to go the path that they have decided to go in history? And at one point in your book, you write, "Black history saved me. It was my North Star." And you also say that Malcolm X was your role model. So talk a little bit about the influence of Malcolm X and the racial tension in your neighborhood, in your area, that sort of influenced your approach to history.
You know, I think Malcolm X is still the most important figure in the 20th century period. And I love Martin Luther King Jr. I think he's an equally, in certain ways, important figure. But the reason why I think Malcolm X is so important is that Malcolm is the Black working class activist of all of our generations, you know, and he's building on Garveyism. He's building on the work of Elijah Muhammad. But, you know, Malcolm, the dignity that Malcolm, you know, and, you know, I wrote a book on Malcolm and Martin, and, you know, I've got more projects to do with Malcolm as well. I think Malcolm is so important because he understands the necessity of human dignity, much more so than any other activist of the 20th century. And the reason he does is because of what happened to him and his family, what happened to his father. His father was murdered by white supremacists. What happened to his mother? His mother is really burdened and eventually is in a psychiatric hospital in Kalamazoo, Michigan, starting by the end of 1938. And so when we think about Malcolm X, Malcolm X talks about radical Black dignity as a precursor to citizenship. And Malcolm is this truth teller who really prosecutes the United States for the series of crimes that it's done against Black people and Black humanity. And so he's doing a few things simultaneously. He's arguing that Black people deserve dignity, but that they can liberate themselves if they look outside of the white Western gaze, which is why Malcolm, way before Kwame Ture, Sokwe Carmichael was saying we're an African people. Malcolm was visiting Africa in 1959. And I love Kwame Ture, and I've written about Kwame Ture. I think he's a hugely important figure. But Malcolm understood that we were African people and we had to find our dignity within ourselves and a history that was wider than the history of our encounter with the West and slavery. And then Malcolm also pushes us to love ourselves and love each other more than external definitions of citizenship and acknowledgement by racist institutions, right? And that's why Malcolm is in debates with Bayard Rustin and James Baldwin. And he's saying, look, he'd be fine for racial integration, but didn't the Reconstruction Amendments, we were supposed to have racial integration. We shouldn't be protesting. And he's saying, what kind of people, and I agree with Malcolm, what kind of people let their little children desegregate schools with white mobs surrounding them? So Dr. King looked at the 1957 Little Rock Central High School crisis, and he sends Eisenhower a telegram congratulating him because of the military troops that are there. Malcolm looks at that. And again, here I agree with Malcolm, not Dr. King. And Malcolm is outraged by the whole scene because Malcolm is saying this is an irredeemably sick society if young people are trying to get into a school and there's thousands of mobs and thugs there trying to prevent them because they're Black, right? It's not a victory lap for Malcolm. Malcolm's saying, this is a house, metaphorically, the United States, that's burning down, and Black people are trying to integrate into a burning house, right? And so Malcolm is unbelievably courageous in terms of his truth telling. And what's so interesting about Malcolm and Martin is that by the end of Martin's life, he's sounding like Malcolm, right? What white folks always try to tell you is that, no, Malcolm starts to sound like King because he talks about human rights and human dignity, especially in 1964 and 65, right? But the truth is, Malcolm had always been talking about human rights. Malcolm had always been talking about human dignity throughout his whole career. And so when you look at Malcolm X, what's so important to me about Malcolm is the discipline and the dignity and the willingness to speak truth to power. So he's both Black America's prosecuting attorney, but he's also our diplomat and our prime minister as well, going to Africa, going to Nigeria, going to Tanzania, going to Egypt and the Middle East, right? Malcolm has an office at the United Nations, and he's treated as if he is a world leader because he is that. Like, people across the world recognize that Malcolm X is this such a significant voice and leader in powerful ways that at times are not recognized in the United States. And the way in which that impacted me growing up in Queens is that, you know, this is a time period of Public Enemies Fight the Power, really a first generation of hip hop that people are pushing back against and saying hip hop is rap music is about crime and thugs and all this negativity. And there was also a group of people who said we had overcome, you know, in the 1980s, you know, the civil rights movement had meant that if Black people weren't doing well, it was their own fault. And I think that finding out about Malcolm X really from home, we had the autobiography of Malcolm X, and then seeing how Malcolm was being sort of resuscitated and renewed and reimagined by a hip hop generation was really, really crucial. And Malcolm showed us that we could speak truth to power against white supremacy while loving our own people and maintaining discipline and dignity at the same time. So all that was very, very appealing to me.
It made me think of racial optimism and the critique of President Barack Obama for his racial optimism as opposed to Black Lives Matter, because the reality is that folks don't want things to change. And I think maybe part of the deeper understanding that people really need to get from you is defining what is white supremacy, because when people think of white supremacy, they have these old images from, you know, the 1900s, the lynching, the Jim Crow, you know, what happened in the marches. And they say, oh, we don't have white supremacy anymore. So why don't you sort of lay it out? What is white supremacy and how does it act today?
Yeah, the way in which white supremacy acts, and this is connected to the lost cause and the redemptionist story and narrative, it really sets up a story and a narrative of America where disproportionate racial outcomes, the overrepresentation of white people in all positive social economic indicators, and the underrepresentation of Black people in all positive social economic indicators, and also the overrepresentation of Black people vis-a-vis negative social economic indicators as just something that's natural and inherent, that white people have the wealth that they have, live in the neighborhoods they do, have the outcomes they have because they're just sort of smarter, they work harder, they live cleaner and more pure lives. And Black people are really relegated to being stereotypes. There's something biologically, intellectually inferior to them. It's about them. It's not about racist policies or structural racism or systemic racism. So white supremacy really rationalizes systems and structures of anti-Blackness as normative, as natural, as the way in which things are through both divine right, but how they should be legislated, how the law should treat it. And anything that disrupts that is going to be responded to with violence. Okay. So when we think about white supremacy, it's really a story. It's the story of American exceptionalism. And it's both anti-Black, but it's also about the dispossession of indigenous people. It's also about racial discrimination against Latinx and Afro-Latinx people. It's about what's happened to queer people, against queer people, especially queer people of color and Black queer folks. So white supremacy, and this is what, you know, when Dr. King says he's against militarism, racism, and materialism, he's really saying he's against white supremacy, because it, the way in which America's version of white supremacy works, it's local, national, and global, right? So we're going to attack Vietnam. We colonize other countries. We scoop up Hawaii and Puerto Rico and act like it's manifest destiny, right? We do all these things and we rationalize it and we say, God gave us the right to do this, right? Native peoples were on this land before us. We scoop up Texas. We do all these different things, but we don't say it's in the name of white supremacy. We say we just are an exceptional nation, right? So part of white supremacy, Hopeton, is this idea of racial innocence too, where no matter what America does, it's always innocent, right? It's always innocent. It's always the injured party and the aggrieved party. And when it uses violence, whether it's in Vietnam or in Afghanistan or Iraq, it's always justified, right? And so when we think about the politics of white supremacy, the lost cause is really the receptacle of that politics of white supremacy, especially since 1865, because the lost cause narrates white supremacy as this heroic, God-given privilege that white people have to deploy violence, to deploy empire and war and imperialism and racism in any way that they see fit. And with no accountability and no responsibility, right? And so that's the story of our time. And really until 2020, folks weren't even talking about white supremacy in a national way and recognizing it, right? And so it's important for us to recognize that. But like I said, because so much stuff in our country and in our realities is about stories, the stories we tell ourselves, it's important to understand the story of white supremacy fits within that story of redemptionism and the lost cause.
You write in the book that Black Lives Matter embraced the radical politics of America's first Reconstruction, embarking on a new mission to fulfill the lost promise of abolition democracy. And I'm going to jump down to this part. Despite the enormous symbolism of the Obama presidency, the substance of their future hopes lay in confronting parts of American history that the nation's first Black president never would.
Yeah, you know, I talk about Obama and BLM a lot here, and I have huge admiration for Obama, and I say that in the book. But Obama represented a kind of top-down vision of Black citizenship, whereas BLM represented this bottom-up vision of Black dignity. And the one that most people, most of our community, Black people, can get access to is the BLM version and not the Obama version. Because most of us are never going to Harvard Law School. I know I didn't go. I don't know if you went, Hopeton. No, most of us are never going to Columbia. I didn't go to Columbia. I don't know if you went, Hopeton. No, most of us are never going to Princeton. I didn't go to Princeton. I don't know if you went to Princeton. You see what I'm saying? So like, right. If that's the price of the ticket, most of us can't get into that vision of citizenship, right? So I don't like that vision of citizenship. It's good for the elites who get that access, but most of us are really going to be like the BLM activists who've had hard times, who've made mistakes, who've had shortcomings, who deserve grace and forgiveness and human dignity and compassion. So that's where I sit. And I think that some of the people Obama most admired would have, you know, would have been connected with BLM, like John Lewis and other folks. So I juxtapose the fact that Obama loved John Lewis because it was easy to love John Lewis. The people you needed to embrace are the activists in Ferguson and Baltimore who are being tear gassed by this racist police structure, right? This racist prison industrial complex and this militarized policing and law enforcement. And so when you think about Obama in December of 2014, meeting with Black Lives Matter activists in the White House, when he met with them, he could have never imagined a Donald Trump presidency. And the difference between them and him is that they could, and they were right, and he wasn't, right? So by papering over the racism in the country through this narrative of American exceptionalism, no blue states, no red states, he actually fanned the flames of a white supremacist backlash, because the only way we're ever going to get out of the bind that we're in is through confrontation, and not, I repeat, not by lying about it, right? That's why the Bible tells us the truth shall set us free, right? So when you keep lying, you just keep building more and more scar tissue, Hopeton. That's what you keep doing, right? It's only telling the truth about how you're feeling, where we are as a nation, that we can do what? We can face the realities and come up with some solutions, right? And that's what I love about BLM. They were willing to, in the spirit of Malcolm X and Ida B. Wells, what were they willing to do? Tell the truth. That's all they were doing. And remember, Dr. King said it. He said, you know, I'm not gonna tell people what they wanna hear. I wanna tell people what they need to hear, okay? So a lot of times when you think about Obama in 2004, 2008, he was telling us all what we wanted to hear all the way up into the White House. But a lot of times that's different from what people actually need to hear.
Well, I think it's very important, because sometimes I think the movement was so dominated by the Black middle class.
Yeah.
And what they want to accomplish, sometimes not purposely, just seeing the world from the perspective of the Black middle class and not being able to broaden their view because of where they came from. And one of the things also you really talk about that's important is the role of SNCC. And specifically, you talked about them propelling the Black freedom struggle beyond conventional respectability politics. Talk about the importance of rejecting the idea that respectable Blacks should cause no trouble.
Absolutely. SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they went to jail. They were nonviolent, but they were confrontational. It was confrontational nonviolence. It was sit-ins. It was voter registration work in Mississippi, in places like Alabama, Southwest Georgia, Arkansas. And they pushed and criticized the Kennedy administration, both John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, the attorney general. They pushed and criticized Martin Luther King Jr. They pushed and criticized James Farmer of CORE. They were on freedom rides. They went to jail and they advocated jail, no bail, because it was SNCC that made people understand that being incarcerated was a badge of honor in this society, right? So when we think about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they are the ones who make us have an expansive vision of democracy, small d democracy, that goes beyond the politics of respectability. So they start to dress in the overalls of sharecroppers, because they are both fitting in, but they respect the human dignity and the brilliance of Black sharecroppers, women and men who oftentimes had virtually no formal education, but who were some of the smartest people and the most generous people you would ever meet, right? And so that's SNCC, and that's really, really important. So the politics of respectability are the politics that say young Black women and men are getting shot because their clothes are too baggy, or they've behaved or misbehaved in a bad way. And that's why Trayvon Martin was murdered. That's why, Michael Brown was murdered. It's just for being Black. There is no different behavior if you are being racially profiled that you can do that's going to save you from the police, right? That's going to save you from getting shot and killed. And so SNCC is a real important precursor to the Black Lives Matter movement. And like I said, I think one of the ironies of Obama and BLM is that they both had real admiration for the civil rights movement, but for different reasons. Because by the time Obama was able to express deep admiration for John Lewis and the civil rights movement by reading Parting the Waters, Taylor Branch's Pulitzer Prize winning study in 87, the civil rights movement had become part of the fabric of the nation, and Reconstructionists had won the narrative war during the second Reconstruction. So it was easy to say, yes, I support the civil rights movement. Ronald Reagan signed MLK's holiday into legislation because he knew a veto would be overridden, and he still thought MLK was a communist, right? And so the harder thing, and this is where I'm very critical of Obama, would be to embrace the Black Lives Matter activists, because there are real political stakes. it's easy to speak at John Lewis's funeral and to eulogize John Lewis. It's easy, right? It's easy to say, hey, Hopeton, I love Nelson Mandela. Is that controversial? Is it, you know, but it's harder to say, hey, what about Alicia Garza and Tamika Mallory? It's harder, right? It's much harder because this is happening in real time, right? And people don't know who's going to win the narrative of war over how do we remember BLM in 50 years? You know, nobody knows, right? And so Obama, as the first Black president, I thought should have shown more moral courage, right? And here I say moral courage because that's what Malcolm had. That's what King had. That's what Angela Davis and Ida B. Wells had, because they're making choices in real time before the history books are written. That's the moral courage. You don't know how this is going to turn out, and you don't know if people are going to say you were right, but you're making the decision. That's the same thing with SNCC. You're going to jail in 1961. SNCC didn't understand that there's going to be people tenured at Harvard University because of what you're doing right here. They didn't know that. How could they possibly know that? How could you possibly know that? That this is going to be so important. People are going to write books and be in the Ivy Leagues and make all this stuff based on your work and your sacrifice, right? But they did it, right? So what I wanted from Obama was that kind of moral courage, right? That's what I want, especially from Hopeton, a Black president who had a bust of Dr. King in the Oval Office, right?
Symbols, but not substance in some ways. And I think it's important that we critique our leaders, right? So you already said you got a lot of great respect for Obama, some of the things he did. But he wasn't perfect, and he made some critical mistakes, just like my favorite leader of the 20th century, W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yeah.
Because talk a little bit about the evolution of some of our leaders. When I think about Du Bois, I think about him writing a telegram to Booker T. Washington, congratulating him on the Atlanta Compromise speech. And then by the time we get to the early 1900s, he's basically an open, you know, political conflict with Booker T. Washington. And this is after Booker T. tried to hire him twice.
Yeah.
And he tried to hire him twice.
He tried to hire him really to muffle any opposition that Du Bois could eventually do. So it's more of a politics of co-optation. No, I think Du Bois evolves over time. And I think Martin and Malcolm do, too. I think Du Bois obviously becomes a socialist, becomes a member of the Communist Party by the end in Ghana. Becomes much more interested in labor movements and movements of the masses. I think he starts out as more of a radical reformer and becomes this really radical, transformational, socialist, social democratic politics. I think that Du Bois, when you think about it in retrospect, because he didn't know, makes some mistakes vis-a-vis those politics in the sense that, look, the Soviet Union is not what people think it is. So, and Du Bois didn't realize that, neither did Robeson. You know, these are totalitarian societies. China is not what they think it is. China is a totalitarian society as well. So they, in a lot of ways, they were groping for an alternative to U.S. Neoliberal capitalism or liberal democratic capitalism in that context. But he does evolve in positive ways in the sense that he becomes much more of a somebody who's interested in mass movements, who's interested in labor movements, who's interested in grassroots political organizing along both the revolutionary Pan-Africanism that he had always espoused, but like you said, really trying to broaden that perspective beyond the perspective of elites, right? And beyond the perspectives of what does racial justice look like for a Black middle class or upper middle class and elites? Like by asking, what would it look like for everyone, right? And I think that's what, when BLM, by the time you're focusing on Blacks who are incarcerated, you're really doing a positive thing because you're saying that the way in which we think about justice has to start with the least of these. So BLM, there's something that's very, very biblical about them in the sense of it's connected to the social gospel as well in terms of trying to transform our reality for the least of these in our society.
Well, the last thing I want to talk about is mass incarceration because of the war on drugs. Just to give you an example, many, many years ago, I went and got some data from the Austin Police Department from one of their officer, someone in command there, just to look at, you know, how many people were being arrested that were African-Americans for drug possession versus the percentage of the population that was African-American. And knowing from the research I did or the studies I've read that African-Americans don't use drugs any more than anybody else. We're just on par with the rest of the population. What I found, and this might be almost 30 years ago, about 20, 25 years ago, is that African-Americans represented more than 40% of the people being arrested for possession of drugs. Yet we were 10% of the population. And when we look at the enhanced sentencing, that was a bipartisan decision.
Yeah.
Democrats and Republicans. And I recall reading that after the fact, some of the Black Democrats regretted the decision to be so punitive with the possession of drugs. So how do we get to where we are today and our role in that and trying to roll that back now?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great point. And there's some great books, Locking Up Our Own by Jim Foreman, that won the Pulitzer Prize, Black Silent Majority by Michael Fortner. I'm well versed in this literature. I think that one, Black people didn't invent mass incarceration. I think that the Great Society's efforts to ameliorate poverty leave behind both positives, but also negatives. And one of the big negatives is the 1968 Safe Streets Act, a crime bill that puts the federal government in the prison business and providing states big grants for policing, for prisons, for all these different things. And Elizabeth Hinton has a great book called From the War on Poverty to the War Against the Poor really looks at mass incarceration from 68 to 1980, really, but how the federal government gets into the anti-crime business in ways that really hurts Black people. Black politicians by the 70s and 80s start to be part of this, but they try to actually have a panoramic vision of ending crime by wanting more social services, less cuts to social welfare programs. But they find themselves and they find, you know, there are places in Detroit and other places where, you know, heroin and in Harlem, and there really is high crime. You can even see it, some of the movies of the time, Hopeton, like Superfly and Shaft. 1971, New York City is seeing white flight. They're seeing federal disinvestment, and they're seeing really, really high rates of crime, right? Petty crime, but also violent crime as well. And instead of trying to invest in those communities, what we ended up doing was investing in systems of punishment. And at times, Black politicians were part of those investments too. And some of that had to do with a lot of the politicians were more or less representing middle-class people who also felt their lives were threatened, their neighborhoods were being threatened, right? And so in a lot of ways, but in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we really had 30 years of just massive investments in the prison industrial complex and policing nationally, rather than investments in not just things like schools, but real community investments, a guaranteed living wage. And also, let's face it, we needed as early as the 60s to start medicalizing drug addiction. You know, so if we had medicalized drug addiction, if we had basically decriminalized marijuana and marijuana possession, but medicalized heroin, Black people would be in a much, much better place, because once white people became addicted to opioids, that is exactly what happened. The country medicalized opioid addiction to the point where some white law enforcement were refusing to put white addicts in jail. They just refused to do it. So I think we got to this in a way, and I think BLM talks about it, and I talk about it in the Third Reconstruction, that what BLM did vis-a-vis mass incarceration was argue that mass incarceration was a gateway to multiple systems of oppression that were connected to prisons. It's connected to immigration policies, connected to mental and physical wellness. It's connected to climate change and environmental injustice and Black children who are disproportionately victims of having asthma and lead poisoning and access to asbestos, right? So they really, really connected it in clear policy ways too. You think about Kimberly Crenshaw's African-American Policy Forum and others. So they have the data, they have the receipts. These aren't people who are just murder mouthing like people used to say in the 1960s. So I do think that there is Black culpability at the level of the middle class and upper middle class and elites and elected officials. But I think that they started to participate in a rigged game that was anti-Black in the first place.
Peniel E. Joseph, the author of The Third Reconstruction, America's Struggle for Racial Justice in the 21st Century, the most important book I have read in 2022. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Hey, thank you, Houghton. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Houghton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.